of Russia. He
It'd be
said,
nice if we actually got along with Russia.
I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia.
The people of Crimea, from what
Crimea was already...
We want to protect you,
NATO.
Ukraine.
NATO was obsolete.
He said he'd consider lifting sanctions on Russia. He suggested he might recognize the annexation of Crimea. He's questioned the need for NATO, and he's hinted that the United States might not defend its allies in a conflict. And now he's president-elect of the United States. How will the election of Donald Trump change the geopolitical equation for Ukraine and in the post-Soviet space? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
I am.
And also joining me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. Welcome back, Natalia. Good to see you.
Thank you, Brian.
So, on election night, Michael McFaul, the former United States ambassador to Russia, tweeted, and I quote, "The biggest loser in the world tonight is Ukraine. Your only hope is to get really serious about reform and keep Europeans supportive." And writing in Ukrainska Pravda, political analyst Anatoly Martsanovsky wrote that it is completely possible that after Trump's victory, Kyiv's importance to Washington will be reexamined. And writing in Politico, journalist David Stern wrote that, quote, "Donald Trump's victory leaves Ukraine alone and afraid." Natalia, is this true? Does Ukraine now feel itself to be alone and afraid?
Just coming over here, I was editing a piece about the Trump's victory, and the reactions in Ukraine didn't really sound that way. And a lot of people were saying that this is at last our chance to get serious about things and free ourselves from illusions and deal with our problems ourselves. There are some other reactions to people say that Obama administration wasn't really that great for Ukraine. It could have done much more in the beginning of the conflict with Russia. And before the Brexit, there was U.S. exit by Obama administration, which left all the Ukrainian stuff to the Europeans to deal with that. Also, people think about how Republican is Trump, how much Republican Party will influence his decisions, because it will control the Congress and the people who will be picked by Trump could be the people who used to support Ukraine very actively.
So you're not expecting there to be much change then now? You're expecting, because with the potential withdrawal of support from the United States, which is still a big if right now, granted, it's still a big if. But if you judge from the things that Trump said on the campaign trail, and that's all we really have to go on right now, he suggested that he may recognize the annexation of Crimea. He didn't say he would, but he suggested it's something he'd consider. His historically has been like hostile to alliances. He doesn't seem to like American entanglements in alliances, and suggested the United States might not even defend our NATO allies if they don't pay more of their share of the NATO budget. Given all of this, it suggests a drawback of America, a less internationalist America, a less engaged America, regardless of what one thinks of whether the Obama administration could have done more or not. Where the expectation right now is that we will be doing less. Does that make Ukraine more vulnerable?
Well, I guess if we're talking about the recognition of Crimea and canceling of sanctions on Russia for invading Ukraine, then I think Ukraine should be not the only one to get really scared about that, because that would mean the end of the world order as we know it, because if you start to draw new borders in Europe, then you really don't know where you're going to end.
And this is the fear a lot of people have. And Mark, I want to quote you to you on your blog this week. You wrote the following, quote, "Ukraine, Georgia, Moldova, and even Belarus are going to have to come to terms with a future in which they are unlikely to be able to count on serious Western support and protection. Putin may have pushed for a Yalta 2.0 division of Europe, but this election essentially hands him half of that deal that he wanted by default. Are you saying it's pretty much game over for these countries? Or are they now doomed to being Russian vassals?
No, I don't think it's game over or they're necessarily doomed. In some ways, I want to pick up on something that Natalia said about precisely that, if anything, it just simply means that the emphasis has to be on the countries themselves. I mean, one can question how far they were carefully and sort of protected and cradled by the West. But nonetheless, there was that sense of a backstop. But I think, just to pull back slightly, I mean, first of all, we need to always remember exactly the constraint that we don't know what Trump actually believes. And regardless of what he believed yesterday, we don't know what he's going to believe tomorrow. And also, particularly once he is surrounded by the whole apparatus of government, the Pentagon briefers, the State Department officials and so forth telling him things, actually presidents tend to be much less powerful and pivotal than we tend to assume, and that they might well tend to assume before they come in. So that's just a necessary caveat. But that said, let's assume that actually Trump does have a serious impact on policy, is willing to, you know, actually care enough to make a difference, and essentially believes what he says he believes. Yes, I think in that circumstance, he has this extraordinarily focused America First notion, which is basically, what's in it for me? This is the geopolitics of the art of the deal. Mm-hmm. And in that context, well, the honest answer is yes, there is the possibility, one could see, that if Russia could offer something enough to say, look, it's worth recognizing Crimea because of the following deal that I'll give you in the Middle East or something like that, that Trump might be inclined to go for it. Now, again, there we then have, we start running up against the constraints.
Right.
What's Congress going to think? What are the allies going to think? So
John McCain will be screaming bloody murder.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I don't think it's going to take too long before that's going to be happening anyway. So, I mean, I think this might well actually become one of the internal fault lines within Washington.
In the Republican Party, and not just in the Republican Party, because there's really a bipartisan consensus in Congress about the need to defend countries like Ukraine.
Exactly. So I mean, I think that there's a difference between, as it were, the kind of the headline formal stuff. I cannot believe that we will see a formal recognition of Crimea, even if Trump wants it. I think, if anything, we're just simply going to see a stepping down. In some ways, Crimea will become like the Baltic states in the Soviet Union. In other words, that technically, formally, the West does not recognize the annexation, but in practice, it doesn't really expect anything to change and doesn't really do much. I think that's the best that Moscow is likely to be able to hope for. And I don't think that's impossible. But again, let's come back to the sort of, again, try and find some hope. One is exactly that it might provide that necessary wake-up call within not just Ukraine, but other countries.
Georgia, Moldova, and elsewhere.
And secondly, look, insofar as we can tell, Trump is extraordinarily not just unpredictable, but mercurial. I was actually talking to a Russian foreign policy analyst the other day who suggested that really the best move for Kiev is to basically send a beauty queen to be the next ambassador to Moscow, to Washington.
Someone in Melania Trump shoes.
Well, oh, dear God. But, I mean, I think the point is, you know, putting aside the sort of the joke factor, which I think was a joke, but I think the bottom line is that, you know, one doesn't know what his attention is going to align next. When it comes down to it, again, if we're thinking in these sort of geopolitical pragmatic terms, well, Europe is still much more important. China is vastly more important. You know, what can Russia offer? Russia can bomb a bit more assiduously in Syria, but in a way that's not anything that Trump needs to. Trump just simply needs to allow them more sort of leeway there, and perhaps join in. He said he wants to do some bombing. But in other terms, we once again come back to this point that actually Russia is really rather weak. And therefore, if Trump is genuinely president as deal maker, it really begins to come up with the question of, well, what can
Russia
offer the deal maker, really? Not a lot.
No, but it comes also to what you're willing to risk. In other words, if Russia decided to go all in Ukraine, for example, we're not talking about Crimea here. I'm talking about the rest of Ukraine, or in Georgia, or elsewhere. is a President Trump going to make any moves to try to deter or stop that?
Well, let me put it this way. Can Moscow be sure a President Trump would not? Here we come, this is something we've been talking about sort of separately, the extent to which actually Trump's very unpredictability is a serious problem for Moscow, because Moscow has got used to being the unpredictable one, the willful one, the one that relies on the West to be the responsible adult, while it throws its weight around and breaks the rules and so forth. Well, now it's got someone who is likely to be equally willful, equally unpredictable, equally willing to break the rules, and yet has a lot more weight to throw around. So in some ways, Putin is now facing his own Putin. So in those circumstances, I mean, again, obviously we'll have to see how this pans out. It might well be that we will get a sort of Trump-Putin bromance to rival Trump-Berlusconi. But nonetheless, otherwise, the question will become whether or not Russia feels it can guarantee the kind of results that it would like.
So the degree of uncertainty might in and of itself act as a deterrent on Moscow, because while on one hand Trump may acquiesce, or he may be a whole hell of a lot more assertive in pushing back than Obama was, or Hillary Clinton would have been. Natalia, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we can't really count on that very much, because we already seen that Putin's spokesman is in Washington, already meeting with President-elect Donald Trump. And I think many people in Ukraine hope that the two characters, as Mark has just described, will not be able to talk with each other, and because they are sort of very similar characters, and that the Russians that break some promise, and Trump will react as he usually reacts to things like that, and then that will be the end of the relations, or the rapprochement with Russia. Unfortunately, Ukraine has had in the process of the campaign has had bad relations with the people close to Trump, like people like Paul Manafort, who is still under investigation by the Ukrainian anti-fraud and anti-corruption authorities for his dealings with the previous administration. So Ukraine still needs a lot to think of what it can offer to the new president, and what would be its agenda, and to start to do it as fast as it can.
Now, what can Ukraine, and I want to broaden this out to beyond Ukraine, because I want to talk about Georgia and others as well, but for the moment, what can Ukraine do right now, going back to Michael McFaul's comment, your only hope is to get serious about reform. What can Ukraine do right now? I mean, you've essentially fought Russia to a tie in a war, which is pretty remarkable. There's a lot of different reasons for that. Russia didn't go all in. They tried to do it in this hybrid sense. But nevertheless, the Ukrainian armed forces performed a lot better than anybody dared hope they would. What needs to be done now internally if Ukraine is truly on its own?
Well, I guess the major thing is to put the state in order and to fight all those cases of high-scale corruption, and to be able to resist to Russia and to show that, because if we believe that Russia did not get in, not because the United States would fight for Ukraine, but because Ukrainian troops would make a lot of damage to the Russian troops, and that would be the cost which which Moscow wouldn't want to pay for conquering Ukraine, then Ukraine has to build up its army.
Mm-hmm. Mark, what do you think? I mean, is that enough?
To be honest, I think that's actually a box that you pretty much can already check. I mean, Ukraine has been spending quite money that it doesn't really have on its military.
Although it's been getting enormous help from the United States and the European Union.
It's been getting help, but the point is that, as it were, the help it's been getting, a lot of it has been technical and training and so forth, which actually incidentally goes both ways, because no one else has any experience, for example, fighting Russian tank units. So actually, NATO has learnt a lot. No, but I mean, Ukraine has been spending money that it could have spent on other things, on its military. And as a result, it actually has a military that cannot stop a full-scale Russian shock and awe offensive if they really are willing to just throw their whole armed might at it. But the point is going to make the subsequent consolidation almost certainly sufficiently bloody that it just is politically inconceivable. So in some ways, that I think that is already done. So the criticism that Trump has of his NATO allies, that they're not spending sort of enough, I think that can be leveled at. It is this question of exactly addressing the institutions of the state, and as much as that, the perceptions of the institutions of the state, which are unfortunately always lagging indicators. And therefore, I think that there'll be this sort of two-pronged campaign. One is to actually sort of address issues primarily of high-level corruption, which in so many ways is debilitating. But secondly, managing to find some way of, I mean, the jargon is these ways, strategic communications. I mean, it's PR or propaganda, call it what you will. But selling the Ukrainian narrative in a way that is honest. Because one of the problems we've seen so far is that certain attempts to sell the Ukrainian narrative have been so out of sync with the realities on the ground, that particularly in Brussels and other European capitals, Ukraine has lost a lot of political credibility, or the Ukrainian government has lost a lot of Ukrainian credibility. So actually what the Ukrainians are going to have to do is not only, as it were, address the realities of the narrative, but also make sure that they can actually sell it, and above all, sell it to a Washington that is not sceptical, but I think under Trump, it'll be a Washington that would rather not deal with Ukraine if it can avoid it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think this is the real risk for these countries. It's not that actually America says, oh, by the way, we've sold you to Putin for a photo op and a six-pack of Stolichnaya. It's rather that just simply they'll say, we're busy. Deal with your own stuff.
Mm-hmm. Natalia, is Ukraine capable of doing these things that Mark is saying? Because it's at times the politics does seem a bit dysfunctional.
Yeah, well, if you had asked me this question less than 2 years ago when the protests in Maidan Square just started, I would say that really the Western support was extremely important, and that's something that the feeling that we're not alone, that we're part of a bigger community of values, was something that gave a lot of strength to Ukrainians to withstand and to get to where they are now. But at this point, I think more and more people start to realize that it is really the homework that they need to do. And this is something they need to deal with the problems internally with the Western support. And I think the Ukrainian civil society, which still grows stronger, and they even say that they are sort of a coalition government in Ukraine, which consists of the Ukrainian civil society and Western allies. So if that coalition holds, then I think Ukraine can still be successful.
Can I ask a question, actually, sure. Sort of following on from that? I mean, obviously we had the news of Saakashvili leaving Odessa very acrimoniously and sort of talking about how Poroshenko was standing in the way of reform and everything else. And obviously that was a blow, both domestically and internationally. But part of me was wondering, because I felt it was always a bit of a weakness, this almost sense of the only way we can reform Ukraine is by bringing in foreigners. Is there any sort of silver lining to be found about actually sort of a Ukrainianization of the process?
Well, I think it was now in retrospect, I think that it was a way to delay the reforms when you can blame the absence of reforms on someone else. And now when they leave, you still have to do something, and you still have to find the way to do it from the internal resources. And there are people who want to fill those positions and who can do this. The only problem is for the establishment to make its mind on whether it wants to have the reforms or not. And in that sense, I think it is really important for the civil society and for the Western allies to unite those forces and to push for reforms, because otherwise there is no internal desire from the people who are the remnants of the old regime who stayed there to reform anything.
Now, we've seen in recent years the pro-Western values, pro-NATO attitudes, pro-EU attitudes on the decline in Georgia, where they were historically extremely high. You've noted to me off mic, Natalia, that we're beginning to see this process take hold in Ukraine. Is there a risk that, I mean, one of the effects of this conflict was to unite Ukraine, famously or wrongly described as divided before, but to unite Ukraine around these values. Is there a risk that now, especially if we have an America that is not as engaged, that these values will, that people will throw their hands up and say, okay, fine, we go with the Russians, because really there isn't a third option there.
Well, people start getting notice that there is a difference between the European Union and the European values. And European values are still very much in respect in Ukraine. What happens is that I think people start getting notice that things are not that good in the European Union itself. And many countries in the European Union do not really respect their own values. And I think that is a cause of disillusionment.
Yeah, no, this segues nicely into what I wanted to talk about next, and that is Europe itself, because a big wild card in all of this is what Europe will do, how the election of Trump will affect Europe itself. I've been reading a lot of stuff that this could be a catalyst for Europe to get its act together, to get a common defense policy, to step up and punch at its weight rather than below its weight in international affairs. I've seen a lot of calls for that, and that's one possible outcome of this. The Europe without America might end up being a stronger and more assertive Europe. That's one. But the other is that the process of disintegration that we're starting to see in Europe could continue. We got French elections coming up next year. The primaries are this month in the French Republican Party, which are actually the key moment, because you're basically going to see essentially, I think, who's going to be facing Le Pen in the second round. Right. And whether it would be Sarkozy or Juppé is pretty important. But you could end up with a President Le Pen in France, or a President Sarkozy who's going to be very friendly toward Moscow. And you're going to see kind of a less French commitment to Europe. Then we got the big one, the German Bundestag elections at the end of next year. That's huge. That's huge, because if Angela Merkel's gone, I mean, game over pretty much, I think. So a lot depends on what happens in Europe. We got a European in the room still, Mark. You still have an Italian passport. What do you see happening in Europe now? How do you see Europe responding to all this? Because this directly impacts on what we're talking about in Ukraine.
I think, in a way, we need to sort of disentangle a variety of issues. I think particularly the problem is exactly it's such a snarl of so many issues coming together, which are actually separate, but nonetheless all work together. The American role was never particularly important in terms of the unity of the European Union. It provided a certain sort of security backstop through NATO, but you know the European Union is not actually a structure that has felt itself at risk until relatively recently. So if we look at the security side, first of all, I think almost certainly we are going to see a greater sort of security awareness. I'm not sure if it's necessarily going to be vested in the European Union. I'm not sure if it ought to be vested in the European Union, for that matter. There's a limit to how many battle groups you can control by committee. I'm being very unfair and very English there. But I mean, I think in terms of more European countries stepping up and hitting the 2% GDP spend on defence that is the sort of NATO minimum baseline, but that still, which most countries don't meet. More and more in the way of regional and bilateral sort of arrangements within NATO. Because actually, I don't think NATO is seriously at risk. I think that is one of the issues, again, in which actually, even if Trump does have misgivings, it's so deeply woven into not just the security architecture, but the sort of the wider political architecture of America's role with Europe. But again, I think that's an area where he'd have massive pushback from Congress if he tried to do anything
about it. And from the foreign policy establishment in the United
Precisely.
States.
And when it comes back to it, I mean, I don't think any of this is important enough to him to really put political capital into it. So I think NATO will remain. Obviously, it will be effective.
It might remain with a less engaged America, though.
Exactly. But again, unless you honestly think that there is a serious chance of military action, which I don't really think there is, that's not crucial for one term. Mm-hmm. Now, if we get, I mean, if Trump is more than a blip, if Trump gets a second term, or if actually this represents a genuine long-term shift in American policy, then that's another matter. But at the moment, again, we
if that's the case, it'd be a sea change, because we're talking seven decades of internationalism here.
Exactly. But I think that's unlikely. But we have to sort of, that's something we're going to have to watch later. So but if we look instead at the European Union, I mean, yes, there are all these centrifugal pressures. Now, ironically enough, the European Union is also something that constrains the nation states. It constrains France and it constrains Germany, even as it also gives it opportunities to give them opportunities. So, I mean, I think that if we see the unpicking of the European Union, I still think we're going to see attempts to, first of all, salvage the economic area, find ways of maintaining that. I cannot see a lot of countries suddenly thinking that we want to go leave the euro with all the massive economic implications that is. I mean, let's be honest, there are questions as to whether Britain really can actually manage Brexit, let alone the politics, but just simply the practicalities. Think about trying in a whole variety of countries, particularly ones that are within the Eurozone. So, I mean, I think we have to see that what we're actually likely to see is a Europe of some kind will maintain as a structure. The problem has been, in some ways, the disconnect between national interests and national constituencies and the perception of a Brussels that is hell-bent on ever closer political union. That is the main fault line. Mm-hmm. Now, if that can be addressed, that is the one thing I would suggest that is likely to have a serious impact on the current rash of exit sort of imperatives or whatever. Because at the moment, the trouble is that basically, as I understand it, I mean, this is just you know, a non-EU specialist, but nonetheless, just from my conversations, time and time again, I talk to people within the European Commission, and they say it's just a problem of education and outreach. We just have to tell people how wonderful the EU is. Now, there may be some truth in that. There is also a deeply patronising element there. The point is, they are clearly committed to a vision of Europe that is not shared by a large proportion of member state populations. So again, this might, if we're looking for the positives, might be the wake-up call, mm-hmm. might be that sign of, look, you know, it's all very well having this lovely dream of a European superstate. But on the other hand, you're faced with a choice. Stick with the dream and actually see the whole thing fragment, or actually go for something that is actually rather more stepped down.
Now let's push that forward a little bit and say, if this is a wake-up call, and if Europe gets its internal act together, can Europe act as a more assertive actor in the security sphere outside of its borders in places like Ukraine? In other words, it can't replace the United States
in a non-military sense, and that's actually all, as it should be. I mean, one of the problems would be if the European Union tried to be a sort of NATO without the United States and without Turkey. Because then, I mean, this is one of the reasons why, for example,
a NATO without its two largest militaries, in other words.
Precisely. I mean, this is one of the things about the whole notion of a European army, an EU army. One of, for me, the biggest strikes against it is the glee and enthusiasm with which every Russian military person, about whom I've spoken about on the question, has welcomed the idea. Well, you know, if Russian generals like the idea, right, then probably Europe ought to be thinking very carefully about it. No, but I mean, this comes back to what Europe can do in the security realm is to recognise the fact that modern security now is much, much less about tanks and guns, or just about tanks and guns. It's about legitimacy, coherence, counterintelligence, financial monitoring, making sure that your electoral system cannot be abused by foreign money. You know, all these soft security issues, and that these are governance issues, and governance is what the European Union is meant to be all about.
Yeah, no, and I've always said pushing back against this non-kinetic war that Russia is waging on the West requires a whole of government approach. But that, even if Europe gets its act together, and that doesn't help Ukraine, that doesn't help Georgia.
Well, it doesn't help it in the sense of you can't just kind of export counterintelligence officers and have, you know, 10 people from Belgium, the Netherlands and Germany turn up in Kiev and say, hey, what can we do? But on the other hand, actually nowadays for a lot of these things, first of all, intelligence sharing, and not just in the spooky sense, but also in terms of financial monitoring and everything else, is crucial. Secondly, training and education and so forth. Thirdly, capacity building in all kinds of other ways. Again, it's not that, say, Ukraine in particular. I mean, with Georgia and Moldova, it's a bit harder because they're small countries. But, you know, Ukraine has a massive human resource. It doesn't lack smart people. On the whole, it has lacked two things. One is just the wherewithal to allow the smart people to do what they need to do. And secondly, the political cover and political support from the very top. Mm. Now, obviously, Europe can't, they can push, but they can't really arrange the latter. That's going to be for the Ukrainians. Mm. But they can, if as it were, Kiev is on board and fixed, they can certainly dramatically enhance the capacity of the Ukrainians themselves to do this.
I mean, the ongoing theme that keeps popping up here is that everybody has to do more, is that Big Daddy might be pulling back and everybody else has to grow up. And I God, being the only American in the room, I don't want to frame it that way because I'm saying it based on things I've been reading coming out of Europe and out of Ukraine. Natalia, any last thoughts before we move on to the second section?
Well, I think Ukraine now follows this saying that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And really, it shows the will that it sees is fading from the European Union. The will to rebuild the state, to address the basic questions, the basic things. And really, the only way how Europe can reject Ukraine is by making itself unattractive, making itself an unattractive example. And we see quite a lot of that. And I'm afraid we can see a lot more of that with the possibility of a referendum in France, the possibility of exit referendums in other smaller countries, mm-hmm. too.
And the results of the French election and the German elections as well. And that's a perfect segue to where I want to go next. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and discuss whether the liberal democratic model risks losing its appeal in Ukraine and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining me here in the studio is Natalia Chudikova, senior editor of RFERL's Ukrainian service and host of the program European Connect. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Дональд Трамп, 45-й президент Соединенных Штатов Америки.
Трамп выиграл президентские выборы в США. Он уже набрал 200...
Экстравагантный, непредсказуемый миллиардер.
Но европейских политиков не ожидали победы Трампа.
Mark, I'm going to quote you to you again to get this section rolling, because you've just been prolific this week. On your blog, you wrote the following in response to Trump's win. The notion that the end of the Soviet idea in 1991 meant that history had ended and liberal democracy had won has long been debunked, but this is pretty much the final spadeful of earth on its coffin. It is unlikely that for the moment American democracy will have anything like the same power of example just at the time when Europe is in a populism and legitimacy crisis of its own. Elaborate on that if you would.
Okay, I suppose to me there are in some ways two models of how liberal democratic values sort of gets pushed. And there is the American model, which without in any way sort of demeaning it, I would call kind of imperial democracy. It's at least a little bit of a sort of brash message. It's confident, it's assertive, it tends to be associated with kind of grand projects and top-level leadership. And then there is a European model, which we could perhaps call the institutional liberal democratic model, which is much more consensual, low-key. Instead of big-picture stuff, it tends to be based on an accretion of small-scale, low-level initiatives and such like, and sort of builds from the bottom up. And both of these, I mean, remain tremendously attractive in general terms. But we have at the moment both of them also in crisis. We have the European model increasingly questioned, ironically, by people precisely populists who are talking about the strong leadership. In other words, who are talking about the very things that the European model is meant to sort of move away from.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, we now have the American model coming under question. It's not just about whether or not you think Trump is a decent human being or not. I'll let everyone reach their own conclusion on that. It's just the nature of this particularly toxic and contested election. And the opportunities that both of these models give the Russians and others, but we're talking obviously the Russians here, but to present actually what on the surface seem quite compelling counter-narratives about hypocrisy, about systemic collusion within elites, about the fact that they just don't work very well. And I think this is the problem. I mean, you know, it's not that I think that democracy is disappearing. I'm actually, you know, as you know, essentially an optimist in the long term. I think we are at one of the sort of sawtooth moments of history.
Yes, we are.
You know, it's the one step back in between the two steps forward, but it's painful at the time.
Now, I want to push back just a little bit on that. And this was the theme of today's Daily Vertical, actually. And the idea, credit where credit is due, came from a video Alexei Navalny put out yesterday in response to the Trump win. And he's saying these are the takeaways Russia should have from this. And after going through all the reasons why he thinks Trump will actually not be good for Russian interests and will not be the great friend that Putin thinks he will be, he makes what I think is the money point. And the money point is, like, think about what just happened in America, regardless of what you think of the candidates who are going to win. Russian television has been telling everybody that this was going to be fixed, that Hillary was going to win a fixed election, that the American establishment was all behind her, that the media was behind her. And indeed, much of the American establishment was behind Hillary Clinton. But guess what? She lost. Regardless of what you think of that fact, he said, the fact that this kind of a candidate could win in America tells you something about American elections. And gee, wouldn't it be nice if we could have elections like that, too? Yes, Mark, this election was toxic and sometimes painful to watch. But at the end of the day, regardless of what we think of either candidate, the fact of the matter is that a candidate who, let's face it, came out of nowhere and was opposed by much of the elite for a variety of different reasons, did win, which just says something about American democracy. No, does it say this idea is still strong? And if this is the lesson that Russians take from this, it could be very dangerous for the Kremlin, is the argument I made today.
I mean, I would love to think so, if nothing else, because the last thing I want to do is quash anyone who's demonstrating more optimism than me. but I mean, I would just make a couple of points sort of in back. And again, this is important. We're not talking about, as it were, what actually happened. We're talking about how these things can be perceived.
Exactly.
and the narratives. Hillary Clinton just about won the popular vote.
She did win the popular vote.
And yet she's not. The sort of president-elect.
Second time in 16 years that happened.
When, if you think about it, the essence of sovereign democracy, as Putin has sort of framed it, has been that actually institutions matter less than sort of the collective will of the narod, the people. That's been the basis, really, of his legitimating ritual. It's not about what you think of Medvedev. It's not about whether you vote for the Duma. It's that you have this bright, shining icon above us all in the clouds of Putin. So in some ways, actually, if you've built already a narrative about popular legitimation, yes, of course, it's weird when you, the propaganda machine can turn on the proverbial dime.
Of course,
it seems weird to actually be able to say, oh, it's going to be fixed, and then it's not. What you're going to turn around and say, my God, look at these Americans. You know, they couldn't even fix their own election. I think you make them incompetent or whatever. No, I mean, unfortunately, I mean, it would be nice to think in those terms. But I think that the point is that most Russians have already given up that particular hope. Maybe if this had been 2011, it perhaps would have had more of an impact. But as is, I think in some ways it plays perniciously to something, generally speaking, that implicitly the Kremlin has been trying to push, which is democracy is dead. It's a silly idea. It doesn't really work. It doesn't change things for good. And therefore, you know, let's not pay too much attention to it.
Natalia, how you've been listening to the two of us go back and forth. How does this play in Ukraine?
Well, I think it's really the scary idea that democracy is dead, or it didn't work, or it's an efficient way of governance. But when you look at the numbers and you see that 25% of Americans who were born after 1980 think that way too, not only the Russians, then it becomes really scary, because what is the alternative that they picture in their mind? And Ukrainians and Russians and Eastern Europeans have lived under the alternative, and they would be able to talk more in details about what the alternatives feel like. So I think it's really very dangerous moment in time when a people who never lived under the alternative, think that the alternative to democracy would be better.
So you say these values are alive and well in Ukraine?
Yeah, because, well, they know what it is. It's very difficult to explain it to a Frenchman, to an Italian, to an American, what it really feels to live under the authoritarian regime or under the dictatorial regime, or why would a country destroy a great percentage of its population, productive population, during the Great Famine in Ukraine, for example. It's very difficult for them to understand that unless they know more about it, and unfortunately they don't.
Mm. Recently, Anne Applebaum, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, said that the West, we are a couple of elections away from the end of the West as we know it. She was speaking, of course, before the U.S. election, but she was speaking of the U.S. election, the French election, and the German elections. Is she right, Mark, or is this overly pessimistic? I go to you because you're our in-house optimist.
Optimist in chief. Look, well, the thing is, as soon as you start throwing in the "as we know it" sort of caveat, then you know you're pretty safe, because obviously everything changes. If we mean the end of the West as, firstly, a sort of coherent political unit, and secondly, a bastion of certain values, democracy, transparency, rule of law, and so forth, no. Yes, at the moment we clearly have these sort of crisis points. And in some ways, it's interesting what you're saying about people who know the alternative, because we actually have this sort of democratic rollback that's taking place in Poland and in Hungary, two other places that know full well the risks. I think we can't see this as being, as it were, a single spectrum of democracy versus authoritarianism. It's actually a much more sort of complex, three-dimensional thing where people are sort of moving around. So I think we have a certain rise of populism, and we have within the European community this particular pushback against a Brussels project. But when it comes down to it, I mean, I feel that certainly once you move away from the post-Warsaw Pact states, even in France, where there has been sort of a certain amount of quite sort of unpleasantness is brought up, particularly by the migrant crisis and such like. And obviously Britain also not without its problems, Germany. But the bedrock values, I think, actually are still strong. Now, it might be that in a way...
I would argue they're still strong in America, too.
Well, no, absolutely. I mean, sorry, I was talking about yeah, Europe. But this is why I don't think ultimately Trump will be more than a blip. I think it's a combination of a whole variety of factors that came together to actually create this particular phenomenon. I don't think this is a grand tectonic shift in politics. And already we are seeing the beginnings of a backlash. And I'm not just talking about people going chanting, "Not my president," but actually people who are saying, let's organise, let's structure, let's think about politics, rather than perhaps a certain complacency mm-hmm. that had taken place before. Democracy is something that has to be regularly refreshed, hopefully not with the lifeblood of patriots, but actually by enthusiasm. The problem with the West is the West got fat and lazy after 1991. I don't that mean that in sort of purely military terms, so that's also part of it, but also politically. We may not have read, all of us, Francis Fukuyama, but we more or less thought that was it. You know, oh, gosh, it was a tough 40 years, but now we can sit back and relax. Well, it's not the case. And actually why the challenge is present now is precisely that there is a growing divide between the bedrock values of the West and a variety of insurgent politicians. But the point is, the reason why this is at the moment proving such a sort of a contentious point is because the insurgents tend to be out of step. They have to manufacture crises in order to get beyond that.
Although, on the other hand, one of the things that's happening in the West, one of the things that drove Brexit to a large degree, and one of the things that drove the Trump campaign to a large degree, was this part of the population that was felt itself disenfranchised, disenchanted, and felt that they were the losers in the globalization process, right? This is one of the things that drove
this. Well, that's one of the narratives. But if you look at the Trump election, the majority of the poor voted for Clinton. If you want to look, it's only after a certain income point that you actually have a majority.
Yeah, you got it. It was in the Rust Belt states, though, where you basically had people who are hurting from, you know, factory workers and so on. And there, but there is a constituency out there that feels left behind by their institutions. Essentially, mm-hmm. This is the case in Europe. This is the case in the, so it's not entirely. There's a lot of manufacturing going on. I will grant you that, but it's not entirely manufactured. Any thoughts on all this, Natalia?
I was looking at the reactions after the results were announced, and some of the articles which attracted my attention were about how do you talk about the Trump, the president, to the children, and. Many of those articles didn't deal with the personality of the new president, but rather with the basics of the community life, with the basics of democracy. How do you organize the community life? How do you talk to people who actually voted for Trump, but they are still the members of your community? You still have to deal with them. You have to rebuild the community again. And I think that is, even if you take the different values that Americans have on both sides of the on different sides of the Atlantic or in the middle of the country, you still have these basic values of the community life, of the civil society, which mm-hmm. still works there. And I think this is the basics where it has to grow up again.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're coming toward the end, and I wanted to get into like this thing of the optimist pessimist thing here, because there's a couple ways to look at this. One way to look at this is we've all been in this place before. We're old enough to remember the 70s, right? We remember the West was in this place in a lot of ways, in terms of the people that believed their institutions were not working for them. You had political angst in Europe and the United States. The Soviet Union seemed to be on the march. We seemed to be losing. But the Western model proved itself to be resilient. It was a blip, to use Marx's words. We're not old enough to remember the 30s. We're not. But in the 30s, it wasn't, perhaps it was a blip, but it was a blip that did a lot of damage before the blip was over. Mark, paint me your optimistic scenario and your pessimistic scenario.
Well, I mean, anyway, the pessimistic scenario can go almost anywhere, so I'll come to that afterwards. I mean, the optimistic scenario is, look, compared with the 20s and the 30s, we have not had the devastation across Europe of World War One. We have not had the profligate stupidity of the Versailles Treaty Accord.
Although the Russians would claim the way they were treated after the fall of the Soviet Union was akin to the Versailles Treaty.
Well, I mean, in some ways, there is some truth in the sense
not
that
saying
they,
that I endorse that, but they
no,
would
no,
say
I
that.
Mean, there is some truth in the sense of they lost a war, the Cold War, but a war nonetheless, and yet have been allowed to sort of claim that it was a stab in the back. Yep. Instead, but the point is, Russia has already gone, not Nazi, not fascist. I mean, obviously, Putin is not Hitler, but in some ways, you know, anyway, we're not talking about Russia. We're talking about, as it were, everyone else. Mm-hmm. Nor have we seen, or are we likely to see, the kind of extraordinary economic collapse that we saw in the Great Depression. I mean, what happened in the 20s and 30s was a combination of often very weak and new political institutions. Democracy was not the norm, and it wasn't always present, combined with these other external factors. So my optimistic scenario is actually that this does represent the wake-up call, that Europe becomes, shall I say, a little bit more serious about security and cohesion and a bit less serious about the sort of rush forward for ever closer political union. That people realise that actually the more divided they are, the more it empowers a whole variety of malign actors. Whether we're talking, you know, Islamic State, whether we're talking Russia, or whether we're talking unpleasant populists of every extreme, but who share one common defining factor, which is precisely they are enemies of the liberal order. So we actually have to think about, well, how important is that liberal order to us? What are we willing to do? This is the question that's exactly beginning to be discussed in post-Trump America. What are people willing to do in order to protect and enshrine the kind of values that they see potentially under threat? Well, Europe has to do the same. And therefore, the optimistic thing is precisely that over time, democracies can be really quite resilient things. They will have to put up with sometimes the rise of unpleasant and authoritarian leaders for a while, populists, maybe even France. I don't actually think a Le Pen victory would be quite as wonderfully convenient for the Russians as they might like to think. But,
although
yeah,
it could be devastating for the European Union.
It would be devastating for a certain kind of European Union. But again, it might actually be what is necessary to do that. I mean, sometimes shock therapy is, unfortunately.
Wouldn't it be ironic if the West had to undergo shock therapy?
Well, wouldn't it be ironic? And wouldn't it be ironic if actually, you know, Marine Le Pen was the woman who saved the European Union? But I said, I mean, now I'm getting
Farage
to the extreme levels of optimism.
Yeah, you're
no, but I mean, the pessimistic and not impossible scenario is precisely that we see actually a fragmentation. A fragmentation not just of Europe and the West and the mutualities that support this extraordinary experiment, after all, in creating consensual law-based structures, but also dramatically empowers those willing to play on those divisions, which, of course, includes one certain VV Putin.
And bringing the states on the former Soviet states into this, like Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova, how do they do
well,
in these scenarios?
If they feel that not only are they going to get no support or credit from the West, but also that in fact the Western model is looking economically and politically sort of bankrupt, then in the longer, I mean, in a way, Georgia already has sort of this constituency that's already made that decision. Moldova, poor Moldova, not sure if it's going to get the choice in any case. Ukraine, I mean, Natalia's going to know better than I, but I'd say even if you might say Ukrainians are not willing to bend the knee, and I think I find that a long way away than actually sort of having some kind of formal sort of admission, but just in practice, the enthusiasm to do anything, the enthusiasm to think you can change it. I mean, the essence of change is a belief that it's possible. As soon as you've lost that, then it's not going to change. And therefore, we're going to see what we've seen after past revolutions, that vast amounts of enthusiasm but just slowly gets consumed by a sense of hopelessness.
Mm. Natalia, last word to you. You're optimistic and you're pessimistic.
Well, I would like to remind ourselves that even though Mr. Putin may be celebrating Trump's victory, Russia is still a very weak economy and socially a very weak country. And it's right on the doorstep of Europe and right on the doorstep of Ukraine. And if all those pessimistic scenarios about Russia do come true, then Europe needs to be strong enough to bear the consequences of the collapse of Russia. And Ukraine would be the country that would probably be again on the forefront of this whole process. And I really do hope that more people would realize that there is a serious and big danger over there, and they need to get ready for that.
Mm. Yeah, no, and in closing, another point I made in this morning's Daily Vertical was that this anti-establishment wave that's sweeping the Western world and that Putin has been exploiting as a blunt weapon happens to be a weapon that's a double-edged sword, because I don't think Russia is going to find itself immune to these tendencies, especially given the rise of labor unrest, the rise of social protest. I think for the time being, Mr. Putin's been able to float above this. I don't think he's going to be able to float above it forever. Although that is still out there to be seen. So on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior policy fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining me in the studio has been Natalia Chudakova, managing editor of RFRL's Ukrainian service and host of the program Europe European Connect. Thank you both for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.